Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware's housing market remains cool as the busy spring and summer season get underway.
Well, the housing market is tough, but I have to say it's improved slightly. But it's still nowhere near what it needs to be in a balanced market.
Contributor Eileen Dalabrida takes a closer look at what buyers and sellers should know in the First State. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear about new research into how a teacher's emotions can affect classrooms and student learning. Arts Playlist explains how Winterthur is bringing a once-imagined gallery focused on Black history and culture to life. And we meet a Lewis-based author ready to release their first novel, In Enlighten Me. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a First State of Mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The housing market in Delaware continues to face some headwinds. So if you're looking to buy or sell a home in the First State during the busy spring and summer season, what can you expect? Is it a buyer's or seller's market? This week, contributor Eileen Dalabrida examines the housing market in Delaware and what's driving it in her latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And she joined me earlier this week to dig into the details. So before we dive in a bit more deeply, how does the market look this year compared to recent years? Generally speaking, is it better or worse than we've seen in recent years?
Well, the housing market is tough, but I have to say it's improved slightly. Interest rates are in the 6% range compared to 7%, and inventory has improved slightly, but it's still nowhere near what it needs to be in a balanced market.
So one issue we always talk about is one you just talked about, inventory. Tell us a little bit more about what that looks like right now specifically.
Well, in New Castle County, listings are moving briskly, a median of 34 days listed in March, compared to the national media of 53 days. About 560 homes were newly listed on the market in March, and that's an 11% increase from March of 2024.
You also mentioned interest rates and the fact that they remain a factor for people. The Fed this week held rates steady. What does that all mean for financing a home right now and how that figures into the equation of whether or not to buy or sell?
Well, the average 30-year fixed mortgage rate will spend most of the year in the sixes. And that's after that short-lived spike above 7%. But analysts say that it will not get below 6% because of continued economic growth and worries about inflation and government debt.
And I suppose that affects inventory because there are a fair number of people who have homes that they bought when interest rates were much lower and they're locked into a pretty good rate. And if you're going to sell out of that rate, you're going to wind up at a much higher rate, right?
Yes. That is a big part of why there is so little inventory. People who bought their homes with a 2.5% or 3% mortgage are very reluctant to trade that in for a 6.5% mortgage.
And we've also seen, Eileen, in the economy, there's worries stemming from uncertainty over how President Trump's tariffs will play out and a myriad of other economic factors. How much do those factors also kind of impact the housing market?
They play a significant role. One of the buyers who I interviewed said that a tweet could go out at any time that would send the stock market into a spiral. So I guess the essence of it is that our economy, as it sits right now, is unpredictable. And like the stock market, the real estate market does not like uncertainty.
And so when we pull all these factors together, interest rates, the economy, inventory, what does that mean for prices? What are we looking at for prices for homes kind of across the spectrum as compared to recent years?
Well, for the year, the median price in Delaware rose 3% from 2024. It's not at the fever pitch that it was when all of this seller's market started getting underway about 5 years ago, but prices are still going up.
So that is perhaps one of the few incentives out there to sell your home. The only problem is if you sell at a higher price, you're also buying at a higher price, right?
You are indeed.
We've also talked over the years when we talk about the housing market in Delaware about one specific part of the market, and that is first-time home buyers. Can you give us a sense of how things have been for them? It's been tough over the last few years for first-time buyers. Is that still the case?
I think it's gotten a little worse for first-time buyers, mostly because rents have gotten more expensive and it makes it harder to shake loose money for savings. And also, we need to factor in student loan debt, which a lot of first-time buyers are still paying down. One study says that to make payments affordable, that first-time buyers need to make bigger down payments, although I don't see that becoming the norm. But in markets more favorable to buyers in past years, it took an average of 6 years to save for down payment. Now it's 12.8 years.
Wow.
In Delaware, it's a little lower, 11.8 years. And in the super expensive LA market, it's more than 35 years.
Wow.
As I said, I don't expect that this will become a big trend, but it really is an eye-opener as to just how hard it is for first-timers.
And is it also a factor of there not being maybe the inventory for first-time home buyers? Is more of the inventory, for lack of a better term, at the upper end of the spectrum, as opposed to for those first-time buyers who are looking for an affordable home?
Well, the entry level has gone up to like 350,000, and anything that's selling between 350 and 400,000 just flies off the market. I spoke with an agent in Kent County who says that most of her listings are from older couples who have second homes. They're affluent and they're either moving to their second home at the beach or in Florida, and those homes are starting at 700,000 up to about 850, and that is not affordable for most first-time buyers.
One other thing I thought was interesting in your piece was something you mentioned about technology also having an impact on buying or selling a home. And we're not just talking about, what we've talked about previously, like drone pictures now being used to help, boost listings. You noted in your story that there's some other areas where AI is coming into play in this whole process. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, it sure is. It's both real estate professionals and buyers are using AI to do research. And one of the things that AI can tell people is a quick hit as to crime rates and market trends in the areas that they've targeted to buy in. And AI can also analyze economic indicators and demographic data to predict how much and how quickly a property will appreciate, which is of great interest to buyers.
I was going to say, it sounds like AI is really giving buyers a chance to come to the table better equipped with information than maybe they could have 5, 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
So, with that in mind, is there any advice for people buying or selling now that might help them navigate the market successfully, beside perhaps using AI to help you out?
Absolutely. If you have your heart set on a home in moving condition in a popular area, come in with a strong offer and look to your real estate professional to guide you as to how high you should bid. Don't lowball. And you can sweeten the pot by being flexible on moving dates. And if you can afford it, offer to pay both halves of Delaware's 4% transfer tax, which is the highest in the nation. Agents tell me that's the quickest way to a buyer's heart. And also, don't forget the personal touch. I spoke with an agent whose client was a veteran, and the seller, who also served in the military, accepted his offer, even though it wasn't the best deal, because he wanted to help a fellow vet.
So building relationships can be important even in buying and selling a home.
Yes.
So before we wrap up, is there a sense of what the long range picture might look like? Is waiting perhaps a better option at this point?
Well, you're rolling the dice. Home prices are continuing to press up, but with the volatile economy that we're now experiencing, that could change. The cost of borrowing is expected to remain high this year because folks with those 3% mortgages are staying put. So I'm not seeing a huge shift in the market, barring some unforeseen and catastrophic event in the economy.
So the bottom line is, if you can't wait 5 years to really see things shake out, you probably need to start thinking about what's the best option for you now. Make the best deal you can.
Sure, especially if you're paying rent. That 5 years of paying rent will really make a dent in your budget. So I think that sometimes it's difficult. I've talked to for buyers, especially first-time buyers who have taken second jobs, but they're doing what they feel they need to do to make the deal go.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for her time this week. Her piece on Delaware's housing market is available at delawarepublic.org. Next up on The Green, we delve into new research examining how a teacher's emotions can affect classrooms and student learning. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We often think about what teachers teach, the lessons and academic goals, but new research from the University of Delaware suggests we should also be paying close attention to how teachers feel. The study, co-authored by UD Associate Research Professor Lee McLean, looks at how teachers' emotions, both positive and negative, can ripple through the classroom, affecting how students engage, behave, and learn. Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon is joined by McLean this week to discuss the study's findings and what they tell us about the emotional dynamics of a classroom.
A key piece of your study is something you called emotional transmission. So to start, can you explain what exactly emotional transmission is and why it matters so much in this context of the teacher and classroom or student relationship?
Yeah, of course. So I'm going to kind of fall back on some foundational learning theory that really helps explain classroom emotional transmission. So the first one is social learning theory, which basically states that in addition to learning new information really explicitly, humans and especially children really learn by watching and paying attention to the social and behavioral cues of the people in their environment. So one of the most significant environments that children are in is the classroom, especially young children. They spend a lot of time in the classroom. Another really important point when we're thinking about the classroom environment and social learning theory is that children look to kind of the more knowledgeable other or the most knowledgeable other person in their environment. And that person is a really important signal for social cues and for behavioral cues. And when you think about the classroom, who's the most knowledgeable person in the classroom? It's hopefully going to be the teacher. And so, you know, this really highlights the important role of the teacher, not only as someone who structures the classroom and you know, literally communicates information to students, but as this really significant point of social reference for students. So students are going to look to the teacher, to the teacher's affective cues, to what they're doing behaviorally, to their tone of voice, and they're going to get some really important information in those moments about whether or not they're safe, whether or not things are okay, whether or not this is a situation they can learn in. And so, with that kind of at the foundation, emotional transmission is just the ability for two different people or a group of people's emotions to kind of play off of each other in an environment. So, if I started acting really, really upset right now, you might start feeling more upset. You might start feeling really annoyed. It's just this tendency to kind of take on and mirror the emotions that we're seeing around us. So when you consider that in the classroom and consider that students are looking to the teacher for this really important social information, it totally makes sense that the teacher is giving off are going to be kind of taken up by the students and reflected, so transmitted. And then that can also happen the other way. So anything the students are giving off, the teacher can take in and take on. So that's what we mean by emotional transmission.
Before we get into the study's findings, you did use a new tool or developed a new tool called the teacher affect coding system. And so did that, it's kind of a chicken or egg here I'm curious about. Did that come first or this study or vice versa?
The study came first. So we went in, we did all these classroom video observations, and then I was looking at tools to use that captured teachers' emotional expressions in the way that I wanted to capture them. And some of them do, but they also capture them in combination with all of these other very important classroom elements, but they were elements that we weren't necessarily interested in. So we really wanted to isolate just purely what teachers are giving off in terms of their emotional expressions so that we could ask questions about specifically when a teacher is expressing certain feelings, how does that potentially transmit to students? And so I've done a lot of observation work in the past. I've observed affect in the past. And so we took one of my lab measures and adapted it for use in this study so that we could actually quantify how much time teachers were spending displaying positive affect and negative affect.
So I know you found that, overall, in this study, you found that teachers showed far more positive emotions than negative ones, but that some teachers did show high levels of negative emotions. A couple things there. When we say positive and negative emotions, just in this context, I can imagine, what they are. I'm sure our listeners can too, but what exactly do we mean when we say both of those? And then what's the distinction there? And then a part two would be, how did those emotions, positive or negative, affect the students and their learning experiences?
And it's really important to clarify what we actually measured before jumping into what it means. Because emotions can be subtle and emotions can be subjective, right? So we really wanted to focus on teachers' emotional expressions that were very overt. Like we didn't want to make any guesses about, if we saw a little eye twitch here or a little tone of voice there. We didn't want to make guesses about how they were feeling in that moment. So we really went for the big positive and negative emotional expressions. So for positive, that could be a really, kind of higher lilting vocal tone. It could be big happy gestures. It could be facing right towards the students and really engaging with students. It could be really positive and affirming language. And then the opposite is true for negative affect. And we wanted to be especially careful with this because we just want to accurately capture anytime we're highlighting something that teachers might be struggling with, or something that they might be able to work on. We want to be sure we're capturing that accurately so that we're not placing undue burden on teachers. So anyway, with that in mind, we really only captured the very explicit, overt negative emotions. So this is when a teacher was using very harsh tone of voice, was saying really overtly frustrated things like, "Why can't you all just be quiet?" Like things like that. So these were not subtle. I think there's room, definitely room in the research space in this area to get into more subtle emotional expressions. But for a first step, we wanted to know for sure that what we were measuring was positive and negative. And we also had an observational code for like neutral or just neither. So that could be any range in between. So we were really capturing these kind of two ends of an emotional spectrum. And you're right, we did find, and it's exactly what you would expect because teachers are wonderful and tend to really love working with kids. They were very positive the majority of the time. But we did find that about 10% of the teachers in our sample had a lot of negative affect. Like they were spending 30% or more, up to 90% of the time in a lesson, displaying this really overt, angry, frustrated, negative emotional affect. So, you asked how this seemed to impact students. We actually found that positive affect didn't have any significant impact on the student outcomes we looked at, which were students' engagement, enjoyment in learning, and anxiety for learning in math and English language arts. So we didn't find anything. We were kind of expecting that positive affect would be this wonderful thing that would boost engagement and boost enjoyment. And we didn't actually find anything. So combined with the fact that this is what teachers were doing most of the time, this could just mean that this is status quo, right? This is what students generally experience in a classroom. And it could be that positive affect combined with some other things is what really helps students stay engaged and really enjoy their learning opportunities. On the other end, though, we found that when teachers were displaying more negative affect, their students were less engaged in their lessons and they enjoyed their lessons less, which totally makes sense. That's exactly how I would feel if I were a student in a classroom being led with a very negative teacher. But it really highlights that these more unique but more extreme negative emotions really are picked up on and transmitted to students. So they do notice, they do internalize, and it does take away from the learning opportunity. So for those few teachers that were really struggling with their negative affect and perhaps struggling with their emotion regulation, that was a really helpful signal for us that, all right, we really need to support these teachers in ways that are going to help them regulate in those really tough moments.
I think one of the things, I took away from the study was, and it partly, I suppose, reinforced what I had already, kind of thought essentially, but that's, that is kids, even very young kids, and children, can pick up on so much more emotionally than we think they do, and that can have very real implications as you just mapped out. So, what are your thoughts on that specifically? I know we've touched on it already a bit, but what are your thoughts on that specifically? And just, I am curious if some of your other work, and reports and whatnot are, line up with that notion.
So I think that is absolutely what our results are finding. I think it speaks a lot to the need for students to feel safe and comfortable in their environment, and the need for their psychological safety to be met in the classroom in order for them to learn successfully. I think that's really, really critical.
Yeah, and the study does. The study makes several recommendations for teacher preparation and professional learning programs. Can you walk us through those and what strategies? It comes off to me. It kind of it's a it takes a village approach in terms of teacher and classroom emotional regulation and whatnot. So, but can you walk us through some of those recommendations you offered and what strategies or other support systems can help teachers and just educators as a whole manage their emotional well-being, so to speak.
I think it is worthwhile to look at it at the teacher level and say, all right, we need to get you some emotion regulation strategies. But even more so than that, and in addition to that, it's really important to look at the system. So the school, the class the teacher is in, the district the teacher is in, overall state and nationwide education policy, and to find the things that are making the job stressful for teachers, and to try to address those things as well, in addition to helping teachers learn to regulate. So that's my big message right now is it's not Yoga Friday, it's not mindfulness and meditation for that teacher just by itself. These issues really need to be addressed systemically so that we can create a working scenario where teachers are more likely to thrive and experience those wonderful positive emotions and be able to make really good instructional decisions and not be burned out and things like that.
Thanks to UD Associate Research Professor Lee McLean and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, and a look at how Winterthur is bringing a once-imagined gallery focused on Black history and culture to life. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A writer for the New York City-based black magazine, The Anglo-African, in 1859 detailed an immersive gallery showcasing the history, culture, and accomplishments of African Americans. But the gallery didn't actually exist. It was an imagined place that represented both a cultural critique and a call for recognition. More than 160 years later, Winterthur Museum is bringing the imagined gallery to life in a new exhibit, Almost Unknown, the African-American Picture Gallery. In this week's edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny catches up with Winterthur's Director of Collections, Alexandra Deutsch, and curator and historian Jonathan Michael Square for a closer look at Almost Unknown.
Dr. Square, tell me about the title of this exhibit and how it came about.
Yeah, so the exhibition is based on an essay that was written in 1859 at the brink of the Civil War by a free African-American man named William J. Wilson. And in this essay, he's envisioning how an African-American museum might look in the future. And so what we've done is brought his vision to life in this exhibition using objects from Winterthur's permanent collection.
Tell me a little bit more about William J. Wilson.
Yeah, William J. Wilson was born free in New Jersey in 1818, and he lived for most of his life in Brooklyn and Washington, D.C. He wrote prolifically for the Black press, and he's a really an understudied figure in African-American history. I think in part because he never published a book, but he's someone who rubbed shoulders with some very notable individuals, including Frederick Douglass. He wrote for Frederick Douglass Papers, which is one of Frederick Douglass's newspapers. So he really is a really interesting figure that really deserves more attention and light.
Turning to you, Alexandra, talk a little bit about some of the works on display, if you will.
It's an eclectic group of objects. It's a very small group of objects. Around 30 objects are in the gallery, and it ranges from something as small as a fingernail. There's a seal that you would use to press an image into wax that asks, "Am I not a woman?" and has a kneeling female figure. It has a earthenware vessel that was made by the Black potter David Drake. It has a probably more familiar image of the Washington family done by the artist Edward Savage. It has some new acquisitions in it. It has a quilt that was made in Philadelphia by a Quaker woman, Priscilla Ballinger. But what is extraordinary is that quilt at its center has a stitched image of an eagle. And through Ballinger's diary, we know that a free young Black man in her household had actually created a sketch of that eagle for her. And that was what she used to create that eagle on her quilt. So I think you can see there's such an eclecticism in terms of the objects. There are also some really moving volumes from our collection that you would encounter, from Uncle Tom's Cabin to the frontispiece for a first edition of Phyllis Wheatley, the first Black woman poet to be published in the colonies. And so through this marriage of the words in William J. Wilson's essay that were the centerpiece for Jonathan, and then this bringing together of the objects with those words, the objects take on this much larger significance and meaning.
Dr. Square, what drew you to this essay as the inspiration for an exhibition?
It's a text that's hard to read, which is why I like it. It's not the kind of text you read and you think, okay, I got it. Like, there's no central argument. I often compare it to Edgar Allan Poe in Uncle Tom's Cabin. It really has the flavor of a mid-19th century sentimentalist literary work, which is also why I like it. The language is very florid. It was also published in serialized form in 7 installments. So there are a lot of cliffhangers in the text. All the pieces of the puzzle don't fit together neatly. And it's not the kind of text that you can easily read in one sitting. And I think the sort of rough edges of the text, or the incompleteness or the messiness of the text, lends itself to an exhibition well. So that's what I like about it.
Alexandra, this is more than just an exhibition of objects. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the multi-sensory aspects of this and how Wilson's essay is woven into this show.
Yes. So what I like to say is that as you walk into the gallery, you not only walk through the essay, but you're surrounded by the essay. So you're surrounded by sound. When you first walk into the gallery, you're greeted by Dr. Square's voice, and he introduces himself as essentially your guide and narrator through the exhibition. Some moments he's reading parts of the essay, but there are other voices that you encounter, and all of them complement William J. Wilson's description of this gallery that never existed. So William J. Wilson's essay is written like a guidebook, as if you're walking through this gallery. And in order to create that experience, we have some visual moments in the galleries that are videos digitally created and moving images. In one case, it is taking you in a visual journey as if you're seeing figures and moving through the Underground Railroad. And in another instance, there are a series of figures who you see moving in a space, and there are actually voices overlain with them who are the visitors, what William J. Wilson calls the visitors in the gallery. So the people who you encounter as you move through the gallery, the tall woman, the gallery boy, Tom Onward, the narrator, you see these figures. There's also a soundscape. So you hear music of William J. Wilson's period. You hear Black composers represented in the soundscape, and you hear the sounds of the environment you're in. So at one point you're hearing in the Underground Railroad, you're actually hearing the sounds now of the Eastern Shore, which is where the Underground Railroad would move through. And it's meant to immerse you in this fantasy world of William J. Wilson's essay.
One piece that really stood out to me is this trivet, like you might set a hot pan on in the kitchen. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about its significance and its symbolism as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The trivet is really interesting. Yeah, it's something that we stumbled upon during one of my wandering through the house. And when I saw it, it made me think of Sankofa. It's heart-shaped like the Sankofa symbol. And who knows if the creator of this trivet was actually referencing Sankofa, but for me, it looked like Sankofa. And Sankofa is an Adinkra symbol. Adinkra is a writing system that was innovated by the Akan people in West Africa. And Sankofa in particular means looking back to the past to construct a more equitable present and future. And I was immediately taken by this trivet and wanted to include it in the exhibition. It's not one of the numbered objects in the exhibition. If you go to the exhibition, you know that the essay has numbered objects, and the exhibition starts off with numbered objects. The trivet is not one of the numbered objects in the exhibition, but it is sort of part of the driving ethos behind the exhibition. And it's the first object you'll encounter in the exhibition. So it's really central to how we were thinking about what to include and how to curate this exhibition.
Finally, Dr. Square, you talked earlier about exhibitions as a way of starting conversations. And I wonder, what are some of the conversations you hope this exhibit starts?
Yeah, so many. I mean, I think when people think about African-American history in the 19th century, certain names are come up over and over again, whether it's Harriet Tubman or Frederick Douglass or W.E.B. Du Bois or Sojourner Truth. And all those figures are important and should be studied and continue to be studied. But there's all these other figures that I think are really interesting. And I think William J. Wilson is one of those individuals. And there's other individuals, whether it's Martin Delaney or James McKean Smith or Marianne Shedd, who's also featured in the exhibition. And so I guess I would want people to think more carefully and with more nuance about African-American history. Another thing I would say is I think the mid-19th century is an interesting moment of African-American ethnogenesis. And there wasn't a consensus about who were people of African descent who were born and raised in the United States. Like, there wasn't a consensus about even nomenclature, which is why the name of the essay is Afric without the A in American Picture Gallery. It was one of the terms that was considered for Black folks or African Americans. The essay was published in the Anglo-African magazine, which is another term that was being considered. So I think this moment is really interesting because there wasn't a consensus that, like, African American identity hadn't fully congealed. Also, on a like curatorial methodological level, I guess I would say I want people to look at old objects in new ways, and because the exhibition is so sparse, you have more time to like sit with the objects in the exhibition.
Thanks to Winterthur's Director of Collections, Alexandra Deutsch, Curator and Historian, Jonathan Michael Square, and R. Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. More information on Almost Unknown, the African American Picture Gallery, can be found online at winterthur.org. And we finish out The Green next with Enlighten Me and our conversation with a Lewis-based author about her debut mystery novel. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. When Lewis-based author Wendy G. started volunteering with the Charleston Fire Department in South Carolina, she didn't plan to write a novel. But her experiences there sparked the idea for a story filled with suspense, corruption, and second chances. In G.'s debut novel, Fleet Landing, an ATF special agent and a TV reporter team up to pursue an arsonist through Charleston and confront the toll that pursuit takes on their personal lives. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon catches up with G for more on Fleet Landing and the inspiration behind it.
Your volunteer work with the Charleston Fire Department essentially led to you writing this debut novel. So to kick things off here, can you give us some more insight into your time as a volunteer with that fire department, how you got involved, what you did, and so on?
That is a great question, Kyle. First, I want to thank you for having me. It's always an honor as a debut author, a miracle to get someone of your caliber. So thank you so much for this opportunity. My neighbor in Charleston is currently the deputy chief of the Charleston Fire Department. He also is the fire marshal for the city of Charleston. And they were having a series of nuisance fires, which actually served as the basis and the inspiration for the story. And he was getting a lot of negative publicity for having the crimes go on for so long the public didn't see the traction that they were actually making. So one evening when he came home, I met him in the cul-de-sac and asked if there was anything I could do to assist. I had left the Navy maybe about 4 or 5 years earlier. And I said, I have some time. Can I volunteer in any capacity? And he said, yes, I need some administrative assistance. Come on down, help me out. Well, that led to the opportunity to rub elbows with real firefighters. I have no background for that. I'm not in law enforcement. I'm not a first responder in any capacity. But being around them, being able to assist them was a great motivation. When I went to work with them, I had no idea that I would become a novelist. I was simply there to serve an administrative assist for them, and then their stories were just too rich to pass up.
Well, that leads me to my next question then. Was there a moment for you then, like some sort of maybe aha moment, or one of those stories that you mentioned that sticks out when you knew that you'd take your experiences with the Charleston Fire Department and go on to write Fleet Landing? Was there a moment or a series of stories or happenings that led you, down the path to being an author?
The fire department gave me great exposure. They opened every door for me. I had as though I was a sworn officer in the department, and I wasn't, but they gave me that kind of access. And hearing the stories, watching them do what they do, my first instinct was to find a way to honor them and their bravery, their ability to serve the public, even when the public, you know, could be ungrateful, frankly, and most of the time, obviously, incredibly grateful. And I just loved it. And I wanted to find a way to capture that moment. And so I began to conceptualize a story. It has no bearing on what eventually became Fleet Landing, but I was trying to write a fire scene, and I brought it into the office one day, and it was about 4 pages, and I read it to everybody. And their immediate reaction was, oh, that's fantastic. That's so realistic. It's just like that movie. And I went, no, 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 stop there. I can't copy a movie. I have to be original. But that encouragement kept me going.
All right. Yeah, I was curious. Yeah, if you had to chase down a raving arsonist or whatnot, and that was,
I did not. I did have some behind the scenes look at what they do to investigate suspicious fires, so that gave me a little background, and then from there I could do some additional research. And then there was the other half of the story was actually kind of ripped from the headlines, to steal that quote. It was a true life story of someone who had been falsely accused and had spent 4 decades in prison. And I thought, how can I mash those two stories together and find a way to make it work? And so that's the story that eventually became Fleet Landing.
Well, with Fleet Landing, then, it does indeed fall into the genre of mystery. So what drew you to that genre specifically as far as your debut novel goes? And this is the approach you wanted to go with. And, you know, and looking at your process here, you know, how'd you go about crafting such a suspenseful story or stories within the story based on, you know, your experiences with, you know, real firefighters?
My background is more in scientific writing, educational, factual kind of presentation. So being creative was a skill set that didn't come as natural to me as the factual accounting. And so I really took time to study my craft, to go to workshops, to join critique groups. And from there, I was able to get a sense of what goes into crafting a novel. With regards to fiction, the mystery and thriller genre, I've always been drawn to that, whether it's books, TV, movies. And I believe the show that came out that really got me started, I think Castle, premiered on TV. And I said, that's who I want to be. I want to be him.
Oh, I love that. Well, what characters then in Fleet Landing do you think might really resonate with readers? As a journalist, the reporter Sydney Quinn makes a lot of sense from where I sit, but I'll say I love the story around Cooper, Bellamy, Coop, and the layers of redemption and family and, you know, and his responsibilities as an ATF special agent are really intriguing to me. But what are your thoughts there as far as looking at characters you think might really resonate with readers out there?
I'm hoping the three co-stars who will be part of the series, the Carolina Crossfire series, Coop, Sydney, and Dino, the police officer. Those are my three co-stars, and they each take a lead in each book. And I'm hoping that they resonate in terms of realism, competency. I wanted them to be first class in their abilities, and yet, you know, have some humor and have some flaws, you know, that they have to work around. The working groups tend to gravitate towards Lamar. They call him a lovable serial arsonist. who burns for, obviously he has a motivation that is left for you to discover in the novel, Fleet Landing. So hopefully, but they do enjoy him as a as an antagonist and trying to figure out why he's doing what he's doing, how he copes with his ordinary life, and then his extraordinary circumstances that he's forced to deal with.
Well, one last thing before we pivot to your book launch, then the title Fleet Landing. I don't think you've mentioned it yet, but where did that title come from? You know, what's the origin story behind the debut book's title?
Two parts. One, I am a retired naval officer, and so I wanted to capture that moment of my background. Secondly, there used to be a neighborhood area in Charleston, and it was where the mailboats and things came in for both the U.S. Navy. There used to be a thriving naval base there prior to a base closure. And also the cruise ship industry, as well as the Port Authority. So they would have operations out of there, and they had this small restaurant there in it that was basically at the end of the pier, and you could drive up by boat and, you know, grab a slider or a ham sandwich or whatever, some seafood, and head back out to sea. I also wanted to, I'm doing physical damage to the beautiful city of Charleston in my story. And I didn't want that to be a real neighborhood, a name that people could say, oh, that's who she's talking about. So I wanted to create a fictionalized neighborhood that resembles, regrettably, some of the more modest and underprivileged areas of the city. And then we're going to clean that up.
Well, it's an incredibly thoughtful approach. It's indeed all in the name. So, Fleet Landing is set to release to the masses on June 10th. So, in just a few short weeks here. So, with a planned book launch at Browse About Books in Rehoboth on June 27th. So, what can you tell us about the book launch, and what we can expect from that?
I am pleased to be at two places in Delaware thus far, Browse About Books and Barnes and Noble Rehoboth, and I'm so excited. Again, as a debut author, it's a privilege beyond my wildest imagination that they would invite me in, and so I'm lucky to do it. We're also doing a launch in Charleston, and I'm hoping to have members of the fire department join me in their private capacity, not their official. We can't mix public and commercial, but they're going to be there to join me. I am so honored and humbled to be able to be at those two locations in Delaware, my new home state. I'm proud to be a new Delaware resident. I've been here about 2 years now, and I'm just honored.
Thanks to Lewis-based author Wendy G. and our Kyle McKinnon for enlightening us this week. And we've hit the finish line for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor Eileen Dalabrida, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.